I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our guest for Into Music Episode 15 is John Snyder. Snyder is a New York City-based trumpeter and composer who has performed with Max Roach, Curtis Stigers, and has recorded albums such as The Scrapper as a solo artist, as well as Snide Remarks with his son David. His latest album is Chinwag with keyboardist and longtime friend Larry Goldings. In this conversation, Snyder recalls his early years as a working musician, his dislike of chops-driven music, and the personal and musical bonds he shares with Goldings. That's on Into Music, coming up now. When did you first become aware of music?
Well, I first became aware of music because I had music in my family. My grandmother was a really fine pianist. You know, when I was very little, my father bought my mom an upright Baldwin piano, and I begged for lessons. I think I was like 6 years old. I just like wanted lessons so bad. But my grandmother would come over the house and play Chopin and Rachmaninoff and Beethoven, and that was really interesting to me, and I loved it. On my father's side, my grandfather played boogie-woogie piano, like kind of bluesy stuff like that. So it was kind of like a two opposite sides of the spectrum. And not till I was older did I find out there was even more music in the family. One of my grandmother's cousins or something was the banjo player for the Paul Whiteman band. And so there was some music in the family I was unaware of. I know my grandfather, he passed when I was very young, but apparently he had a wonderful sort of operatic voice. I mean, he didn't pursue it professionally, but there was music lurking around. And I begged for lessons on piano, and I practiced pretty hard when I was young. But then I always had a thing for improvising. I would take Fur Elise and start improvising around it. And so that was in there.
You're a little bit of a rare bird in the sense of a kid begging for piano lessons.
yeah. And then, you know, and then I came to trumpet like a few years later in fourth grade when everybody got an instrument. And I begged for trombone, and they're like, dude, you are so short. No. So what's your backup? And I was like, trumpet, you know? So that's how I came to play the trumpet.
Was trumpet something that you had heard and you're like, man, that's really attractive? Or was it just kind of like a spur of the moment guess?
Well, there was a music store in town named Central Music. And the guy who owned it also led, you know, a very popular like private party band. And like in Boston, we called them GBs, General Business Gigs. In New York, we call them club dates. I remember sitting in with his band on piano when I was really little, and he was a trumpet player. So I thought trumpet was cool. His name was Bobby Kovner, to use a Boston accent, Bobby Kovner. But, you know, it was definitely in my mind that I liked the trumpet, and I just wanted to be in the band. So it was fun.
By the time you picked that up, you had already gigged. How did that happen?
I wouldn't say it was a gig. I was a novelty who could play The Entertainer by Scott Joplin or plunk down if they were doing, maybe I could play some blues chords or something. But I was just a little kid who could. It was just really a nice thing of the older musicians to recognize if a kid had some talent and give him a shot to play and get a little bit of applause. It was very nice of them. Because I probably wasn't as good as my mother said I was.
Once you took up trumpet, you know, was it like an immediate, like I'm in love with this thing and this is all I want to do? Or did that kind of take some time?
It didn't take that long. You know, I've always loved music. I mean, where it took over is in high school. I wanted to be in the jazz ensemble, and I could have been in it on piano, but I was really excelling on trumpet starting from fairly early on. And I had a good teacher. My band director, who ran the entire music program in Brockton, which was massive, was a guy named Vincent Macrina. And I studied with him and I was showing talent in it and I enjoyed it. So all that love for piano practicing, that started falling off and I started shedding trumpet harder, you know, as a, who knows, 12 years old, 13 years old. My parents would come home and say, oh yeah, I practiced the piano and I just arranged the music and kind of in a way like it had been out and I'd been playing, but of course I wasn't, you know, probably marauding the neighborhood, getting in trouble, but unbeknownst to them. The trumpet definitely took over in high school and I loved it. Maybe because I was a little cocky pain in the neck, that trumpet went well with my personality back then. But I just loved being in the band and that was my social scene. And it was easy to do so on a brass instrument. And that really took over in high school. Although all of my first gigs playing standards started my freshman year of high school, there was a senior saxophone player named Chris Canales, and he hired me for his group and we would play, you know, odd jobs playing like Autumn Leaves and stuff. And so I played standards on piano for a year, my freshman year of high school already. I was playing some gigs doing that. And that was a great learning experience too, just playing. Even though the guys were just a few years older than me, they were older than me, but that's always good.
I mean, it's not unheard of that somebody would have a gig that young, but that certainly is, at least in my experience, a little bit rare. So what was that like to get out and perform for people, you know, outside of like the school auditorium setting and possibly earn a little bit of money at it?
Yeah, well, I was also in a rock. You know, there was a couple times our family went through some hard times and I delivered the Boston Globe at about 5:30 in the morning. It might have been almost 2 years. So I could save up money and buy an electric piano that I could play in this rock band my brother and I had. My brother's a really great jazz guitar player, Bobby Snyder. And so but back then we were playing rock. And believe it or not, we would go play nursing homes, playing like Black Sabbath and the Doors and classic, you know. But they were just happy to have guests. But occasionally we would get a gig. But definitely in high school, I started playing out. And I love the feeling of communicating with an audience. I really enjoyed that. And I wasn't a shy kid. There was something evidently, you know, very special to me already about playing for an audience. And making a little bread was nice, too. It wasn't really till I went to college my freshman year that I really started earning. That was up in Rochester, New York. So it wasn't like I was making a lot of bread in high school doing it, but I think I knew that this had to be a part of my life in some kind of way moving forward, no matter if it was going to be my vocation or something else.
Yeah, I always kind of liken a career in the arts where it's sort of like you start off and you're swimming close to shore and then you get further from shore and you can no longer see it at some point and it's like it's too late to go back.
Exactly. There's no turning back. It's funny, just to take this one step further, when I went to college, even though I had won all these national awards and high school and I was in the McDonald's All-American Jazz Ensemble as a trumpet soloist, my parents were understandably petrified of me going to music school. So I didn't apply to music school, but I did find a school that was right for me. It was the University of Rochester. And because the Eastman School of Music was part of it. And I had a friend whose father was a professor there and I went and visited and it just blew me away. And there was a lot of good musicians on the main campus who weren't part of Eastman. The Eastman School of Music was part of it. That's oddly enough, that's when my brother is the guitar professor now. But in a weird way, that made me want it even more. And because I had the ability to participate in the ensembles down at Eastman, I ended up playing in the high jazz ensembles and all that stuff. And I basically was fully integrated into their program in a way, even though I was a political science major. But it made me want it even more. And that's also when I started gigging. My freshman year there, I joined a salsa band And I was out playing every weekend. And then later in the year, I found myself into a couple of jazz quintets. And then, yeah, all my time in Rochester was working all the time. And I loved it. And but that was the big eye opener. But not being a music major made me realize even more that I couldn't stop it. It was who I was. But I love the experience of, well, of not having to be a music major. So it I don't know. I think it's good both ways.
So as you were doing those, hustling, essentially, I mean, that's what you're doing when you're gigging like that. Were there other players who kind of, were looking out for you and kind of giving you tips, or did you feel like at that point you kind of had it down?
Oh no. And that's the funny thing about being a musician. I mean, I'm 54 years old, and I just scheduled a trumpet lesson with someone who I think is a really interesting player and teaches a particular method of trumpet that I'm interested in. So I've never gone back on that. But back then, I had a professor, Bill Dobbins, who was head of the Eastman Jazz Ensemble and ran the Eastman Jazz program for many years. And he was a humongous influence on me, especially when I was like 19. He was an incredible historian who helped root me in the entire jazz pantheon, and introduced me to all kinds of music. And I did an independent study with him once where I, at a very young age, where I brought him tunes and yeah, he was a huge influence. And then there were some, upstate New York has a really fertile jazz scene. And there was a couple of musicians who, well, there was just some older cats in town who I got to play with a lot. And they had an incredible influence on me. There was a couple drummers that when I'm very young, I joined this guy, Mike Melito, who's a burning drummer. He's got a bunch of records out. I joined Mike's band. I joined this guy, Rich Thompson's band. And we were playing out, and they were older than me, not by much, but enough that they had more experience than me. And they hired musicians who were more experienced than me. And I learned from all of that. I even learned from all the salsa gigs and I played a bunch of Italian festivals up there playing polkas and yeah, anything. Just like I learned from all of that. And I think it was a way to grow up in the music that I feel was pretty healthy. Because I find, and I have friends and my brother who are in academia, and like, how do you bring that element of that into the classroom? Music has become so academic, but just the whole street side of it was so, that's more where I learned. I picked up some things, but I just learned on the bandstand and by being inspired by the records and older musicians. And a lot of that is learning how to comport yourself on a gig and how do you handle your business and all that stuff. So I learned sometimes the hard way, but I learned.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. To me, it's always been important to draw upon a broad spectrum of music. I certainly have things that I love more than others, records I return to more than others. But, somebody says, "Hey, do you want to hear this new EDM LP?" I'll listen to it because I just want to know what that is, and I want to know what the idiom is about, right?
I get that, especially because I have a sideline to my career besides being a jazz trumpet player. I have a music production company, and we do tons of music for advertising and Netflix and all this kind of stuff. And especially when I was more of a staff writer in my previous position, I had to write every kind of music from orchestral to hip hop. So I had to, if there was an idea presented to me, they wanted to be in this music to live inside a certain world, then I had to immerse myself in it and not be a snob about like, I only play bebop. Forget you. I can't. Honestly, I like the way that it's informed my music. I think when I was a young person, even though I did like some things about electronic music and all this kind of stuff, I did get into a head about what was the real thing. And Now, to me, everything is the real thing. So I think good music is just good music, and it's maturity in a way.
Yeah, let's talk. You mentioned earlier loving the live performance, and you know, having a respect for the audience. Somebody might come into a club and this is their first encounter with whatever group you're playing with. You want them to come back, right?
Yeah.
So how do you go about kind of cultivating that?
Well, it's funny. Everybody has their own style. I mean, Larry's is certainly a wry wit, and he's got so much talent for. He's so unique a person in the way he presents himself and his band. It's just really unique. But people, he has such an online presence with that vibe too that people come to expect it. He's also a more well-known musician than I am, but I just think it's important to, you know, and I learned a lot of this from working with singers. You know, I've been touring for like 20 years with a great jazz singer, Curtis Stigers. And I watch not only how he takes care in presenting his music to the audience and building a set and holding interest, but the way he talks to them about the music, you know, and I love when people, not everybody has to get up here and give a spiel about each tune. But I think it's nice to occasionally during a set explain a song, why you were inspired by it. I know my son, who's a really talented young jazz trumpet player as well, likes to do that. He likes to talk about the next song he's presenting. Jazz is making a really nice comeback right now. The clubs are full. And I think it's nice to have a communication with your audience, especially in a club where people won't shut up, you know? And it's like, how can you get their attention? It's like, well, maybe tell them something about it. You know, make a connection on a human level. Because it's not news to me that what we do a lot, everybody digests it differently. You know, I think people hear, they hear dynamic changes, loud and soft. I think they hear tempo changes, slow and fast. I think they hear flurries of notes. I think they hear little notes. And if you're maybe telling a story, like a theme and variations, but 99% people who listen to jazz are not going to be like, oh, there's a E13 flat nine. John was playing a, you know, diminished scale on that. Nobody gives a crap, you know? And it's like, how do you resonate with that? And how do you tell a story and how you pull someone in is by timbre changes. Do you change the melody and play it with a clarinet and a flugelhorn instead of just finding ways through your music or your record to tell a story? And for me personally, the way I like to hear music, I just feel like there's so many guys with chops now, you know, and it's fun for all that, but it's like, what are you saying? Are you leaving room within your statements that leave a response from the rhythm section and create this whole democratic conversation within your music? And I think people pick up on that. If you're just going bananas, it starts to become, for me, that's like one of those Transformer movies that where there's just CGI coming at you like a million miles an hour. And when I would go to the movies with my son to like when he was a little kid and to see those, I would just fall asleep instantly. It was just like, it was like a constant, like no story, just like, bam. And it's funny. He said, and when he was like seven, he was like, well, why does plot matter? You know, and now he's the complete opposite. Plot is everything. And so I think telling a story with your music is like really important. And I love talking to the audience, especially if it's a really important piece to me. And, you know, I had a piece on my record I did with my son, which I wrote for this Holocaust survivor, Louis Bannett. He was like the Dutch Louis Armstrong, and he survived Auschwitz by conducting the camp orchestra. And I took the numbers tattooed on his arm, and I made a melody out of it. And my friend had written a book about it, and I spoke with him about it. So whenever I present that piece, I present it. You know, I tell the story about it, and then people are in, they're invested. You know, I'm not playing that piece to be controversial. I'm just saying you can make lemonade out of lemons, and let's all kind of like chill out a little bit. but it doesn't have to be that heavy. You could just say, hey, I was inspired by this Wayne Shorter record, and here's a piece I wrote. But at least make an effort to communicate I've seen it in some really loud clubs now in New York, and I don't want to name them. I've seen people get on the mic and then try and engage the audience, and then maybe half of those people who won't shut up while you're playing are actually like, "Oh, I'm going to check this out. He's talking to me." So.
As you were talking about, not blowing people away with chops, apparently Monk would tell people in his band, when they take a solo, just play the melody. Right? Like, you don't have to just play the melody. But within that, the respect between performer and audience, can you talk a little bit about the importance of respect within a band?
Well, yeah, I can definitely talk about that. First of all, Thelonious Monk is buried about 500 yards from where I'm speaking. There's a Ferncliff Cemetery is right behind my house, and his grave is right there. And he's buried with Nellie and Boo Boo right in that cemetery. It's pretty, it's pretty amazing that we can go over there. Tad Dameron and some other people, Ossie and Ruby Davis. It's a pretty famous cemetery. To bring up Monk and in his choices, I mean specifically Charlie Rouse. My son, it's like his favorite musician is Monk, and his first solo he transcribed was Charlie Rouse's solo on Stuffy Turkey. And it's just the most, it's just full of little melodic nuggets that he plays rhythmically that interacts with Monk so beautifully and is so related to the tune, which is great. Not just like I'm not considering what I'm playing on here. But respect within band is so important. I mean, and specifically to talk about Larry and I, we've always had like this ESP. I mean, not only are we good friends, and that helps. Sometimes you can make music with people you're not connecting with personally, but on the bandstand you can. But I think it helps. You know, it's like being on a great basketball team. Not everybody can score 40 points every night, but you're subjugated to who your opponent is and what system is going to work best for that night or for that tune or whatever. But as I love listening to how people respond, you know, it's truly a conversation and a language. So if I play something in my solo and I change the quality of the chord, Larry's literally all over it. And vice versa, if he changes something, and obviously we have developed ears, I'm all over it. But then it's not like I hear what you're doing, I'm copying it. You know, it's like I'm coming up with something that can furthers the conversation, you know, and this is what I love about the bands that I've been that I've had a good time with. You know, they're you have to be in service of the music that you're playing, and then you need to be in service of each other. You know, we're all in this together. You need to play with really good time. So it's swinging and it all feels great. You know, if it doesn't feel good, I mean, if I'm in a band and the drummer is playing, I'm way too on top and pushing, I can't stand that. It makes me nervous. I look for people who make me feel comfortable and don't overplay because that's another thing for me about modern jazz that gets me too much is everybody has to be responding at the same time to every little thing that's done. If we were in a conversation like that, it'd be impossible. It'd be like a giant filibuster where everybody's just yelling and it's like, "Oh, I hear you. I hear what you're saying." It's like, wait your turn. And like sometimes that's what makes Art Blakey great or anybody is that they can just lay it down and interject occasionally to say, "I feel you on that. How about this?" And so communication in the band to me is really great. And to me, maybe it's a product of being over 50 now, but subtlety is king. And I love that. And to talk about the Larry relationship with that, I mean, we've played together in different ensembles, but this thing about doing a duo project where it's literally just a conversation like you and I are having is so special. And it's not unique that nobody's done it, but I think our version of it is highly personal, and I'm just so proud of it.
That communication between you is so clear on Chinwag, and it's apparent to me listening to it that you really understand each other. So I don't know if there's so much a question there as an observation.
Yeah.
But that's kind of that's not something that you can really plan or anything like that. That has to be, that just is really down to the chemistry, right?
You know, that, I mean, that nails it on the head. You know, why do certain people like playing with other people? I mean, but we've always had a chemistry for playing together, but especially in a very sort of open situation where we're not just playing entirely within a pre-programmed framework. We can go up there and play just totally free, which sometimes we do. And it's not unique, but our version of it is personal to us, and we connect. Like, it always connects. It just always feels great. And whether we're playing, you know, an old UB Blake tune or like a completely reimagined Thelonious Monk tune, I think the concept of how we're approaching it is similar. It's rooted in the history without being beholden to any one thing. And if I sat back and sometimes thought about how incredibly special it is for me to be playing with Larry, I mean, he's had just this insane, incredible career because everybody connects with him. That's the thing about Larry. He's like the preeminent accompanist of our entire generation for every kind of music, from pop music to funk music to jazz to modern jazz. Like he has a way of integrating himself in every situation that just feels like he was there when it started, you know? And he does so much homework in so many different classical genres and early jazz genres and stride piano. And, you know, so I sometimes have to pinch myself about that, but I can't say it hasn't occurred to me sometimes while I'm in the middle of this, how lucky I am to be a part of it. But there must be something about my playing he's enjoying too, and that's why we do it. So it's cool.
I'm Jed Bodwin, and you've been listening to Into Music. Our guest has been trumpeter John Snyder. His collaboration with keyboardist Larry Golding's Chinwag is out now. You can find Snyder's music at Bandcamp and on digital streaming platforms. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Production assistance is provided by Fletcher Powell. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast at kmuw.org and send us email at info@kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.